This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
How about a little pick-your-own economic adventure today, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday today, the 14th of October. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. And honestly, I'm kind of torn. What is the most useful thing to start with today? Inflation and how it is still very much a thing, even though you kind of know that already? Or the labor market and how it might be becoming a little bit less of a thing to worry about? Let's do jobs, because, you know, why not? There was some seemingly unreservedly good labor news today. It came in the form of our usual Thursday peak at first-time claims for unemployment benefits. In the before times, an indicator that did not get a whole lot of love, because it's really volatile. It bounces around a whole lot. But in these pandemic times, the number of people losing their jobs every week has hit nosebleed levels, which is why it is a relative pleasure to report that just 293,000 people filed initial jobless claims last week, down more than 10% since the week before, and the first week below 300,000 since March 14th. March 14th of 2020, y'all, a year and a half ago. Now, what does it mean? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman starts us off.
The weekly jobless claims numbers tell us in near real time, like last week, how many people lost their jobs because the economy or their company is struggling. At the beginning of the pandemic, that was millions of workers every week. Earlier this year, it was still 700,000 to 800,000. Now it's under 300,000. Mark Hamrick is at Bankrate.com.
The good news is new claims have really now tiptoed closer to pre-pandemic levels. Fresh job loss, while obviously potentially devastating for individuals and families, is not the key issue for the economy right now.
What is key is getting unemployed people and those who've left the workforce in the pandemic back to work. In the last few weeks, more than 150,000 workers have gotten off the unemployment rolls. Betsy Stevenson at the University of Michigan says the waning Delta wave is playing a big role.
They're more comfortable going back to jobs because now there's a vaccine mandate or there's not as many cases in their community. It could be that employers are getting a little bit better with the offers that they're giving workers.
Declining first-time and continuing unemployment claims tell the same story here, says economist Bill Rogers, director of the St. Louis Fed's Institute for Economic Equity.
The nexus of power has shifted from employers to workers, and they're responding to the fact that Target or other companies have been, in the past year or so, have been raising their wages.
Now, I promised Kai in our news meeting this morning that I'd try to rein on the good employment news parade at least a little. So keep in mind that first-time weekly jobless claims, new layoffs, are still about 90,000 higher than before the pandemic. And nearly 2 million more workers are collecting weekly unemployment checks. We're making progress, still a long way to go. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
It's true, he did promise that. Didn't know I was going to be quoted on this program, though. Anyway, having led with jobs, we will follow with inflation. Hoo boy, is it still a thing. The producer price index came in this morning. Inflation at the wholesale level, of course, up 8.6% last month versus September a year ago. You want the silver lining? Estimates were for an 8.7% PPI. You take your wins where you can get them in this economy, gang. On Wall Street today, oh, everything's fine, apparently. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a new report out from the International Energy Agency, the executive summary of which is, if I might paraphrase, yeah, that's not going to be enough. The United States and other big economies, as you know, have said they are going to cut greenhouse gas emissions. But the IEA says the cuts that have been promised over the next decade are only about 20% of what it'll take to limit global warming to 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius. And the agency figures that means we're going to have to invest a lot more in clean energy, which would have a whole bunch of economic benefits, something like 13 million new jobs and a $1 trillion clean energy market that would rival the size of the current oil market. Which sounds great, right? But $1 trillion is, first of all, a boatload of money. And what might a $1 trillion clean energy market look like? Anywho, Marketplace's Samantha Fields is on that one.
To get these kinds of numbers about how many jobs X policy might create or how much economic opportunity, researchers often start with demand.
So we demand electricity. We demand fuels for our cars.
Melissa Lott is research director at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. And she says there's a lot of data about all that demand.
And what the models do is they say, how much are we going to demand in the future? And then how do we supply that demand in a net zero, zero carbon world?
So, for example, how many cars would need to be electric and how many wind and solar farms would need to be built?
They can then try to figure out, you know, how many solar panels is that? Therefore, how many manufacturing jobs is that?
Amy Myers Jaffe runs the Climate Policy Lab at Tufts University's Fletcher School. She says just like there's lots of data about demand for electricity, there's also plenty about how many people work in the energy industry now.
People who work with the ships, people who work with the drilling. And then we also know how many people it takes to install solar farms and to manufacture batteries.
Put all that together, she says, and researchers can reasonably extrapolate how many jobs might be created by transitioning to more renewable energy, and how much money there is to be made from building and using all that new infrastructure.
These kinds of estimates are helpful.
Richard Newell is president of the nonprofit Resources for the Future.
They both express the substantial magnitude of the opportunity, and they also express the scale of the challenge. And those are, I would say, kind of two flip sides of the same coin.
And both sides, he says, are important for governments, businesses, and society to see. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Look at this economy the last year and a half or so, and you notice, well, I mean, you notice a lot of things, but one of them early on in the pandemic for sure was that a lot of people are moving around. Maybe it was time for a change anyway. Maybe the pandemic made them do it, but they were moving. And even in the before times, work and quality of life and increasingly the climate has made people pull up stakes. Question is where we might go in the future. That's part of what Parag Khanna tries to figure out in his new book. It's called Move, The Forces Uprooting Us. Parag, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much, Kai. Great to be with you.
Talk to me about these forces that are uprooting us. They are different now than they were a generation or two ago, yeah?
Well, they are accumulating forces. If you think back tens of thousands of years, climate actually drove where we could live and settle. And now, of course, there are additional forces that drive where people live. We have politics, the expulsion of people, and so forth. Economic factors, famines, as well as failed economies, failing states. If you think about the Rust Belt after the financial crisis and people moving from north to south, right? And now, of course, you also have factors that relate to demographic imbalances and people looking for jobs, filling jobs and labor shortages around the world. And now climate change has come back again. And all of these forces are colliding and slamming into each other at the same time. And that's why the future of human geography is going to look very different from what we're used to today.
Are we equipped as a people to handle these changes, these migrations?
Well, it depends on what you mean by we. I will say that historically, Western societies, particularly the United States and Canada, have been incredibly good over the last couple of hundred years in absorbing waves of migrants from all over the world. So we wouldn't be the mass migration diverse society that we are today if we were not already very good at handling this. And a lot of people hear this phrase, mass migration, they think that it's something we haven't done before. In fact, it's absolutely part and parcel of human history. And so, yes, we have a great track record, and we should build on that when we face this uncertain future.
You know, when people move, right, for choice, not for reasons of obligation, whether it's climate change or what have you, they take their stuff with them, right? They sell their house, they take those proceeds, they invest it in another house wherever they are. I wonder if the forces that you say are acting upon us now might do one of two things. Number one, make people more reluctant to move because they don't want to leave their economic assets behind, right? Or number two, go broke when they move.
Well, sometimes you don't have a choice in the matter. You could be a Californian who's lost your home in a fire. You could be a young person who has no assets at all, of course, which is very typical of young people today. They don't own homes. In this book, the protagonists are the 4 billion young people, because I'm setting out to answer the question, where will humanity physically reside? And because young people don't have children, they're economically insecure, they're seeking stability financially and environmentally, they are going to be prone to move around, and they are going to think less in terms of nationality and more in terms of their own individual livelihoods.
True story and anecdotal, but and certainly not young people, but it sort of goes to that point. My wife and I were having dinner the other night with a couple who we've been friendly with for 20 years, and we started talking about climate change and moving and all this and that, and they had already sussed out Calgary, Alberta, Canada as a place mm-hmm. they were going to go. They did the pluses and minuses, and they looked at climate and land prices and all this and that, and which is a long way to get to this question. Are cities of the future ready for all those people who are going to be coming, right? The Calgaries of the world.
Well, cities always win. You know, part of what is intrinsic to the human story is urbanization, which is to say clustering in ever larger numbers in cities. And the fact that young people or old people may be moving away from San Francisco right now or LA or New York doesn't mean that the city has lost. New cities are rising and growing, like Calgary, like Toronto. And that is what the future is going to be. It's going to be more and more people relocating into climate stable areas, and hopefully creating these stable, multinational kinds of enclaves that are the centers of our future human civilization.
Where are you going to go? Have you decided yet?
Berlin. It's a place I've lived numerous times over the last 30 years, and it's basically like my home away from home.
Parag Khanna, his new book is called Move, The Forces Uprooting Us. Parag, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai. Me too.
Coming up.
We wanted to make sure we were first in line.
When you want it bad, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 534 today, 1.5%, closed at 34,912, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ found 251 points, about 1.7%, 14,823. The S&P 500 up 74, also 1.7%, 44.38. The season of big banks' third quarter earnings continues. Basically, Financial Shark Week, right? Shares of Bank of America beat expectations, up 4.4%. Wells Fargo went the other way, down 1.6%. Samantha Fields was telling us about the pledges many countries have made to reduce greenhouse gases. So how about some clean energy stocks, huh? The renewable energy company NextEra rose 1.5%. First Solar gained 0.1%. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year T-note. It's back down again, 1.51%, just like old times. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. So here is a labor market story with, at first blush, somewhat of a niche impact until you start thinking about the food on your plate. More than 10,000 workers at the Moline, Illinois-based John Deere are on strike. Deere, of course, being the maker of those big green tractors and all kinds of other farm and construction equipment. The walkout covers more than a third of the company's workforce here in the United States and in Canada. So we asked Marketplace's Caroline Champlin to make some calls out the farm country.
In Bakersfield, California, Edwin Camp grows tangerines and vegetables, and he's just wrapping up his fall almond harvest. He's worried a prolonged strike could make it hard to find the equipment he needs, a problem he's already facing.
We've had all kinds of supply chain problems, yes. The inability to get items when you want it.
And he isn't just a farmer. He also owns a John Deere dealership with four stores in the Central Valley, another side of the supply chain. And that hasn't been easy either.
I mean, it's not like you've got big inventories built. You got by. You took care of your customers, but then the strike hits and you, I don't know, what can you get or not get?
If the strike goes on long enough to be a problem for Camp, he expects his customers, the other farmers, to be frustrated too. Brian Duncan is vice president of the Illinois Farm Bureau and a livestock and soybean farmer. He's also plenty familiar with the fragile state of the farm economy right now, even without a strike, and is having trouble finding things too.
Pesticides, herbicides, fertilizer, the equipment that we run, the parts that we need. I'm not even sure the suppliers know entirely what is going on.
And being in Illinois, home of John Deere, the strike feels kind of personal.
It's important for them, not only for us on the farm to get these issues resolved, but for the people that work in our communities.
And it's not just about the U.S., says UC Davis agricultural economist Dan Sumner.
Yeah, well, John Deere's the largest farm equipment company in the world.
Sumner says demand for Deere tractors has been high, and the company has been doing well. He says the strike could get in the way of that, depending on how long it goes. I'm Caroline Champlin for Marketplace.
We talked about the producer price index a little bit up at the top of the program. Lots of detail in that report, of course, among which is this nugget. Aluminum prices? The highest they've been in almost 20 years, and the rate of increase in those prices, how fast they are going up, is going up. A 9% increase just August to September. So, if aluminum is your business, well, here's today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Adam Schaller. I am the vice president of Lakeshore Diecast in Baroda, Michigan. We manufacture aluminum and zinc die castings. So we take aluminum ingot and zinc ingot and inject it at high pressure into metal molds to produce goods for any number of industries: automotive, heavy durable goods, consumer products. When the pandemic first hit, we ran the company at a loss because orders sort of dried up. So we were producing goods and not selling goods, basically, and just piling up inventory. But June of 2020, things started to come back. And then by mid-August, we were really up 25-30% on sales compared to that month in 2019. You know, we supply a lot of parts and pieces to the construction industry, contractors. So as soon as people, you know, kind of realized they were stuck at home and they couldn't spend their money on travel and vacation and things like that and started doing home improvement projects, the customers that we supply in those sectors, their demand really took off. I've been doing this job for about a decade, and I haven't seen a swing in prices from low to high like I've seen in the past year and a half. There was almost no demand and a bunch of supply, and so prices on everything from aluminum ingot to natural gas dropped to about 50% of their typical level. Now they're almost 1.5, maybe 2 times their historical level in a lot of cases. And so we have to pass on the price increases or else we wouldn't be able to survive. And that's been difficult, having to talk with our customers, you know, sometimes monthly and raise prices. So as far as what's good for us is, because international shipping is so backed up, in the short term, there's not any other option other than domestic manufacturing. So that's given us, you know, pricing power. We can raise our prices to our customers and we can bargain a little bit. We've added probably another 8 people or so just to meet demand. So we're definitely planning on expanding. I think we're well positioned to do more work. I'm pretty optimistic.
That was Adam Scheller. Lakeshore Diecast is the company. Baroda, Michigan is the place. Tell us about yourself, would you? We cannot do this series without you, so please drop us a line. Marketplace.org/myeconomy. I'm no expert, but I know good barbecue when I have it. I am not, by the way, going to get into the whole which kind of barbecue is best thing, because that is a lose-lose deal. But my point is that barbecue is everywhere now, and it's good, too. People line up for hours to get it. Pitmasters charge top dollar and wind up on Netflix shows, and they are winning James Beard Awards as well. It's come a long way, barbecue has, from its economic and its cultural roots. I'm really hoping Andy Euler got time to eat while he was reporting this story for us.
It's a little after 3 a.m. on a recent Saturday in Lexington, Texas, a town of fewer than 1,500 people about 50 miles northeast of Austin. Street lamps are furnishing the only light at 516 Main Street, and you can hear cattle in a barn at the end of the block. There are about 25 people in camping chairs lined up outside a place called Snow's, listening to music on Bluetooth speakers and chatting about just how crazy this looks. It's not Black Friday. Nobody's going to go home with a big screen TV. These folks are here for lunch.
We love barbecue, man.
A guy who just gave his name is Milton, and about 6 of his buddies drove down from Dallas, about 3 hours away.
We wanted to make sure we were first in line, so we left last night, man. We didn't want to leave anything up to chance.
That's because when the barbecue runs out, that's it for the day. By the time Snow started serving at 8 a.m., more than 200 people were waiting in line. Milton says his party tried all the proteins on the menu: brisket, pork ribs, sausage, turkey, chicken. It all lived up to expectations, but it wasn't cheap.
Today I spent $93 on my plate. It's for me and my wife, and we've got some stuff to take home with us.
The brisket was $27 a pound, about 4 times what it cost when Snow's opened in 2003. Now, barbecue didn't used to be like this. Snow's 86-year-old pitmaster, Tootsie Tominant, says back when she started in 1966, barbecue was a way to get rid of the meat she and her husband couldn't sell at their butcher shop.
It was your leftover steaks.
You may have a string of T-bones. You did not move T-bones that week. Or ribeyes. You've got a couple of sections in there hanging in the cooler. You can't keep them forever. So what do you do with them? Saturday barbecue.
With higher prices and popularity have come more ambitious barbecue. Damian Brockway's barbecue trailer in Austin is called Distant Relatives. He took a DNA test and traced his roots back to Nigeria, Mali, and Cameroon, and he's incorporated those traditions into his cooking. His brisket is $36 a pound.
Any cheaper, then it's like it becomes hard to turn the lights on. We're not slaying it and dropping all this money to the bottom line because a lot of it's eaten up by cogs, and it is labor intensive.
The cost of meat is up more than 12% from last year, and historically, labor has been underrepresented in the cost of barbecue, according to Daniel Vaughn. He's barbecue editor at Texas Monthly Magazine.
The amount of labor that goes into making barbecue hasn't really ever been rewarded much, because from an outsider, that labor is just seen as something for the business to absorb.
Because forever, it's been a family business. Brian Mays is the pitmaster at Sam's Barbecue on Austin's east side. He's been doing this for 46 years and says raising prices is just about keeping up with the times.
You cannot be in business staying at $2 from 30 years ago for a sandwich. You cannot do that, boss. As time change, you change.
Mays has been offered a lot of money for the ground that Sam's Barbecue sits on, but he's not interested. He says he's making plenty of money selling barbecue. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Kind of makes you a little hungry, that story did, didn't it? Anyway, this final note on the way out today, LinkedIn is done in China. Microsoft announced today it's shutting down its professional networking platform in China, saying in a statement that there is a, quote, significantly more challenging operating environment and greater compliance requirements in China, which means basically that that's it then for Western-based social media sites over there. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. I saw this on Twitter the other day. It struck me kind of funny, not really in a ha-ha way, though. The U.S. Mint tweeted, and this is a quote, "Facilities are running at max capacity. However, we are experiencing limitations that all manufacturing entities are facing, restrictions not present pre-pandemic." It's going to make it tough for Jay Powell to print all that money, huh? It's a joke. I'm kidding. He doesn't actually print the money. He just uses a special keyboard in his office. Fed chairman only. All right, we're going. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, and Diantha Parker are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.